Well, this provocative question now that'll no doubt be exercised this year with all those renewed calls to dismantle the Daesh group. Does terrorism work? Now, it prompts a mixed response if you consider for any time. Personally, I can remember years in London during the 70s and IRA terrorism, which definitely affected, in some lasting ways, my personal behaviour and attitudes. The question is, though, do the terrorists themselves really achieve their own invariably very big and diffuse aims? So without wanting to provide any justification for acts of terror, does terrorism really work in terms of achieving political or religious goals that otherwise appear beyond the horizon? The Belfast-born political historian Richard English has explored the provocative question, does terrorism work, in a new book with that exact title. With his formidable depth of knowledge about modern terrorism over the past 40 years, Richard English has looked at the history of particular terrorist groups to judge whether we can learn from the past when dealing with the threats of today. So, Professor Richard English, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thanks very much indeed. It's good to be with you.
Did you set out with some trepidation asking this question?
I did, because it's a question which annoys everybody in a sense, because obviously most people's reaction to terrorism is that it's just something which is so unthinkably cruel and appalling that you don't want to ask about the rationality of those who are involved in it. But it seems to me that the thing that really changes history is not so much terrorism, but how we do respond to it. And I don't think we can really respond to it effectively unless we understand the degrees to which it does work or the different ways in which it does work. And that will affect policy, it'll affect societal responses, and ultimately it'll affect the ways in which history is changed by this kind of violent strategy.
Yes, I mean, clearly you're looking for patterns, and that is the great gem of humanity, is that you can try to discern that. I mean, clearly we don't want the answer to be yes, that it does work. And even if it's a no, does terrorism continue, Richard, because people believe it's a way of achieving their objectives, certainly at a time when it's sort of asymmetric warfare, where they're up against much, much bigger foes?
I think that's the crucial point, really, that the most serious terrorist organisations can only keep their momentum going because enough people think that it's the only effective way of bringing about necessary change. And I really wrote this book because I wanted to know how far they were right in having that assumption. And what I try to argue is that overwhelmingly, terrorism tends not to produce its strategic victory, its strategically headline goals, the things that organizations most want. But I think the reason it continues is because terrorism offers other kinds of rewards, tactical successes, not so much strategic successes, but tactical ones, or diluted versions of strategic success or secondary goals. So in that sense, what I'm arguing in the book, which has become controversial with some people, is that terrorism is a lot like many activities that we carry out as humans, that we don't get the overarching strategic goals that are number one priorities for us, but we get tactical successes or we get partial diluted versions of what we want. And that's enough to keep most people who are involved in it for a long time, tragically.
Yes, very interesting. I mean, you focused on four case studies in your book: Al-Qaeda, the Provos, the Provisional IRA, Hamas, and ETA, the Armed Basque Nationalist and Separatist Organisation, which we don't hear about these days. And why those organisations?
Any organisations you choose, you're going to get some people saying you've chosen the wrong ones. But what I wanted to do was to move away from only focusing on Islamic or jihadist groups, because that's what we're mostly interested in now with ISIS or with Al-Qaeda. But I wanted to point out that there's a long history of other kinds of ideological movements being involved. I wanted it not all to be European, but I didn't want us to forget about the European violence of groups like ETA in the Basque country or the IRA in Ireland. And above all, I wanted to look at whether or not there were, across these different causes, these different parts of the world, these different periods, some kind of echoes, not neat patterns, but echoes between groups and their experience. And I tend to argue that there are, that even groups as different as Al-Qaeda and the IRA share some results in terms of their outcomes, that they're better at tactics than they are at strategic victory, and that for some people involved in the terrorism, there are what I call inherent rewards. In other words, the things you get psychologically or emotionally or in terms of revenge or in terms of comradeship, which aren't really political in one sense, but they're emotional and they're kind of inherent things that you benefit from in terms of terrorism, even if you don't achieve your main goals.
Is violence inevitable? That's a very important question, and I think you show no.
I argue not. I think that quite often you find that there are grievances which don't produce terrorism. So, for example, yes, the Basque group ETA has pursued violence to leave the Spanish state, but Catalonian secessionists have not in Spain. Yes, the IRA pursued violence to leave the United Kingdom, but Scotland is far more likely to leave the United Kingdom and has been non-violent in its nationalism. So I think probably what you're looking at more often is a series of contingent factors which make some conflicts spark into violence, but many others not. So we focus on the ones where, for example, ethnic groups fall out with each other and carry out violence. But most ethnic groups that live next door to each other don't carry out violence. It's just that people like myself don't tend to study those because they're not as newsworthy through their violence. But I think holding on to the fact that violence isn't inevitable is a really important element of hope in what's normally a depressing subject.
Can states overreact and augment terror? What's your judgment there, which is, I would have thought, particularly a delicate issue?
It's a very delicate one because obviously it's entirely understandable after the 9/11 atrocity or after atrocities like Bali, in which so many Australians died, for example, that states want to be seen to do something and do something dramatic. What I argue is that quite often you find that the reactions of states exaggerate how much of a threat terrorism represents. And however understandable that is, it often makes it worse. So I think the Israeli response to Palestinian violence, I think the Spanish state's response early on to ETA, the British Army's response to the IRA in the 1970s, certainly, I think the immediate war on terror after the 9/11 atrocity. In all of those cases, for example, I think there was more of a heavy-handed military response than was probably appropriate or effective. And however difficult it is to be restrained and proportionate in our response to terrorism, I think that probably intelligence-led policing is a much more calm and effective way of dealing with terrorism, for the most part, than a military response. And in a sense, state overreaction is the worst thing that you can get. And it's often what terrorists want to provoke, of course.
And this is a related question, I suppose. In judging that, you say don't overreact, but do you look at the impact on the societies around them if they do succeed, so that you actually might get disproportionate responses from the citizenry, which then prompts the governments to say, well, we've got to prevent this at all costs?
It's a very good point. And for example, where I'm speaking from in Belfast in Northern Ireland, one of the things the state felt it had to do against the IRA was to be shown to act strongly so that Protestant paramilitaries, Protestant terrorists wouldn't take the law into their own hands. The difficulty, I think, is that it's very hard for armies to deal with non-state actors like terrorist groups. They're not tending to be in uniform. You can't easily distinguish them from the population. So you tend to get what we refer to as collateral damage or counterproductive brutality by the military. And this isn't me criticizing the army. I think they're in an impossible situation. It's just that you often generate more recruits through the things you're doing to try and stop terrorism. So many of my IRA interviewees said that in some ways the British Army, when they did overreact, they were the best recruiting agents for the IRA that the IRA ever had. And so while I can totally understand why states respond emotionally, because states involve humans too, of course, it's something which seems to me to be a lesson which again and again occurs, that if you have a proportionate response, you're more likely to save lives and stop people from being maimed through this awful violence.
Let me just tell listeners that Professor Richard English is my guest, who's written a very interesting book, a very densely sort of cross-checked book called Does Terrorism Work? In fact, your chapter on the Provisional IRA is excellent because you've interviewed some of the leading members from the time. But the conflicts ended, well, essentially, I suppose, not necessarily for people who lost family members. But it really only concluded when a more pragmatic approach was adopted by the main players, you point out. Is this a rare occurrence historically to get this sort of shift?
I think that it's an occurrence that takes a very long time to develop. And I think it's something which probably requires that the leadership of the group in question has decided that plan A is not working. Is that the normal response? I'm not sure that it is. It happens from time to time in conflicts that are famous. So I think, for example, in Northern Ireland, as you say, we've broadly moved to peace. I think the Basque country and ETA's campaign has broadly fizzled out and there are more peaceful political strategies. I think it's the case at the moment that what's happening in Colombia with the FARC is probably moving to the same kind of pattern eventually. And I think eventually what will happen with a group like Hamas in the Middle East is that they will move mainly mainly what their activities involve, will move to non-violent rather than violent activity. The difficulty is that these are very long timelines. We're talking about decades of violence, decades of polarization, and I don't think there's anything inevitable about it. It involves players on all sides responding to those moments when there is some kind of historical opportunity to move from violent politics to less violent means of disagreeing with each other.
Yes, I don't think it's in your book, but I remember seeing a very good documentary where about a significant priest who was involved in dealing with Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams and various people in the Northern Ireland conflict. And he asked a particular question of them all: what will victory really look like? And they didn't have a good answer. And after all of the tactical victories, but the strategic mistakes, that question started the thoughts to move beyond violence. Does that resonate for you?
Oh, it resonates very much here in Belfast, but I think also in the Colombian experience, I think also in certain other conflicts as well, where what happens is that leaders who think that they're going to achieve one kind of outcome through violence find that when they're not, they want to make some kind of hard-headed decisions, at least to cash in what they've done for some kind of return. A number of people involved in these processes say that if you move down a few rungs, you won't get what you always really wanted, but you'll at least get some kind of returns for the violence and for the struggle. I have to say, the people I've interviewed who've been involved in terrorist violence are often very hard-headed and pragmatic people. They tend not to be dreamers if they've been in an organisation that's carried on a conflict for 30 years. And what happens is you need people like the priest you're referring to, Alec Reed, to engage in a kind of discussion which says, look, does this go on for another 10 years, another 20 years? How do you think you're going to get something worth that extra struggle for? And if they think they're not, they may well turn around and say, well, is there another plan? At that point, governments have to be creative and say, there's another way of pursuing political goals than violence, which is more effective. That's a rare moment historically, but when it happens, you can save hundreds, even thousands of lives.
Grab it. Therefore, probably my final question, how significant is all this for us dealing with ISIS at the moment?
I think at the moment there's no real possibility of any kind of negotiations with ISIS, partly because of the crisis in Iraq and particularly Syria being so awful that there's not
because you haven't got that potential of political response there.
I don't think the response is there or there's any kind of solution we can get to at the moment. I do think in the end, eventually what will happen is that the violence that ISIS are carrying out will turn out not to produce what their rhetoric suggests it will. At that moment, I think the key thing is to try and say, are there ways of producing as much legitimate control over territory as is possible? The difficulty now in Iraq and Syria is that the destabilization is so extensive that it's far beyond anything in the IRA case or the ETA case, or even I think in Israel and Palestine. And in that sense, I think we're talking about a generations-long crisis with ISIS, which will occasionally spill over into other countries as well, including, I fear, regrettably, Australia and the UK and Western Europe too.
And I mean, I should just say Al-Qaeda, which was one of your four chosen areas. I mean, how do they figure in this? Because they're quietly continuing, and some people say really actually building underneath, well, everyone's attention is turned to ISIS or Daesh.
I think you're absolutely right. Al-Qaeda hasn't gone away, and it is undoubtedly the case that there will be a regrouping and there will be future violence. One of the things my book is trying to argue is that while we focus obviously on the most famous group at any particular historical moment, we need not to forget that there are other groups which are off the radar for a time in terms of publicity. Al-Qaeda will continue to carry out violence, and much of it will be lethal and awful. And in that sense, I think the challenges from terrorism never really come from only one famous group. And while everyone currently focuses on ISIS, we really shouldn't take our eyes off the other kinds of groups that carry out violence and how best and how most calmly and effectively to respond to the challenge they represent.
Look, thank you very much indeed. I must say I approached the book with some trepidation, but I've got a lot out of it. Thank you.
Thank you indeed. I've really enjoyed that. Thank you.
And Richard English is the Wardlaw Professor of Politics at the School of International Relations at St Andrews in the UK, also Director of the Hander Centre for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence. And his book, Does Terrorism Work? A History, is published by Oxford University Press.